Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview with a 102 fever and very little ability to speak clearly. Brought to you today by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook at www.audiblepodcast.com/MRmedia. That's Mr. Media. That's where you'll find more than 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player. That's audiblepodcast.com/MRmedia. Okay, so where was I before the commercial and the coughing? Oh, right. Mr. Media is recorded live from the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Business leaders today are looking for every possible advantage to grow their business. Of course, that's not a whole lot different from years past, except that instead of wanting to enhance their operations, many need this knowledge just to stay in business. For that reason, a solid book of business lessons taught by someone who's been in the trenches and led and studied himself is always a hotly sought-after commodity. Enter David Russo, author of 17 Rules Successful Companies Use to Attract and Keep Top Talent, Why Engaged Employees Are Your Greatest Sustainable Advantage. Russo spent 19 years as VP of Human Resources for the SAS Institute, which won numerous Quality of Work and Quality of Life awards during his tenure. More recently, he founded Eno River Associates to consult on best practices and workforce strategies with companies of all sizes. David, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate being here.
My pleasure. And I'm going to apologize at the top to you and everyone else for my insistent coughing. I can't seem to shake it today. Sorry.
Quite all right.
So, David, we've got about 25 minutes to convince listeners that you and your new book can help them in tough times. Are you ready to go?
Sure.
All right. Well, first of all, why 17 rules? I mean, most business books are 10, maybe 12, but 17 is an odd number.
Yeah, it is an odd number, Bob, and I had planned in putting the ideas together for the book to have a dozen, 12, no more than 12. But as stream of consciousness works, I got to a point where I realized that some of the ideas I had that were about these rules could not be aggregated under a single topic. For example, I could not really put ethics with behavior. I really could not put contribution with effort without sort of confusing possibly the reader and certainly myself about the true separation of these attributes of the rules. The other thing is that In the introduction, I make it clear that not all rules have to be applied at all times. So I tried to separate them so that any leadership group, any CEO, any management team could say, well, this rule is really more important to us than that, and we'd like to work on the application and the behavioral change to require that rule rather than the other. So that's the reason for the 17.
Well, and I was going to ask you if you could tell me one rule of the 17 that a business leader just can't live without.
Well, telling the truth.
It may be too late for some of them.
You're absolutely correct, but my feeling is it's never too late. Maybe you have a lot of regeneration of trust to go through if you've been not really forthright with your employees and the people you deal with, but in telling the truth is critical because most organizations when they deal with their employees have a behavior pattern that indicates that either they don't trust their employees to know the truth, or they don't believe their employees can handle the impact of the truth, when in reality, these employees are the same people who deal with divorce, death, taxes, bills, dysfunctional families, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, every day. And when push comes to shove, what goes on in the business world may be in third, fourth, or even fifth place in the things that really impact their lives.
Now, moments before we went on the air, I was watching a few minutes of the Toyota hearings in Washington today. So people listening to this will know that we taped this in February, and the CEO of Toyota was there. And I mean, here's a situation where the company lied to consumers, lied to employees. I mean, you know, this book may not be enough to help them fix their situation.
Well, you're right, and I feel somewhat of an anger towards the corporation, and I feel somewhat sympathetic, as hard as that may be to believe, towards Mr. Toyota himself, because here is a person at the top of the organization who is straining for competitive advantage in the automotive industry, and because he took his eye off what was really going on and maybe took his hand off the off of the wheel for just a moment, the people working for him, in an effort to create competitive advantage for Toyota, cut corners, created falsehoods, and hoped that the problem that appeared to be on the forefront would just go away. And then once they got caught, it started to spin. And I related to a number of years ago, Bob. Do you remember, the Tylenol catastrophe?
Sure.
When in Illinois, the Tylenol was tainted, not by any fault of Johnson & Johnson, but the product was tainted, and Tylenol took an entirely different approach. They took all the Tylenol that existed off of the shelves, destroyed it, came up with a safer cap to avoid the contamination, and then put it back out there at a cost of millions and millions of dollars to Johnson & Johnson.
They did that in a pre-internet era where word traveled fast, but not as fast as it did now. And they were
proactive. They didn't PR people out. They didn't send their PR people out or their engineers out to say, well, this is not really a problem. They said, oh, gosh, this is a real problem. We're going to take action to make sure that doesn't happen, because they believe their trust with the consumer was critical to their competitive advantage, and it proved them right.
Hmm. Yeah, that was quite a case. I don't know how that would have been handled in the internet era, or maybe we're seeing that with Toyota. It's hard to say, because things spread so quickly now. Word gets around so fast. All right. Well, I didn't mean to get us, kind of off topic there, but
fine.
My sense is that the subtitle of your book gives away whose side you're on. I'm thinking you're pro employees, or the value of employees.
Well, I'm pro the value of employees. I am a capitalist. I'm a business person first. I don't see myself as somebody who sets himself up as wagging the finger in the faces of corporate leadership. Business is about making money and being successful and sustaining the lifeblood of the organization. I agree with that. And you do lots and lots of things to make sure that happens. But doing it at the cost of having high-quality relationships with your employees is, in my way of thinking, just a counterintuitive behavior. And companies and their leadership do it over and over again. They deliver messages subtly or directly to their employees that they are interchangeable parts, that their value is diminished in comparison to cash or equipment or buildings or whatever. never realizing that it's the employees who make the, you know, who make the company go forward. I, you know, I can't think of an instance in my career where, you know, the wealth of the company was not built on the backs of the people who work there. And employers, for some reason, lose that. They forget it is the company is the people, first and foremost.
Are you suggesting that employees should be coddled by the corporation?
Not coddled, dealt with as adults. And in adult behavior, I learned this, you know, many, many years ago, in adult behavior, you tell the truth, you lay the situation out there, you give the person an opportunity to make a choice on how he or she is going to behave based on the way the management behaves. And that's what I think. I mean, now, excellent treatment of one's employees is not always done in tangible modes. I mean, it's not all about cash and benefits and all the perquisites. You know, excellent treatment of employees is sometimes done in the way you recognize them as individuals, you encourage them to grow and develop for their purposes and the purposes of the company, you support that growth and development, you pay fairly, you reward contribution, not politics, not status, but contribution. And these are things that individuals, as a part of human nature, recognize as the type of personal recognition that gives the individual the ability to judge what the employer thinks of him or her as a person.
Hmm. Now, you spent all those years as an executive in human resources, so I mean, it's not surprising that you feel strongly about how people should be treated, I guess.
Well, I would say that's pretty accurate.
How do you deal with executives, or how have you dealt with executives over the years who have not had quite your approach to the handling of employees, who, you know, want to treat employees like cattle and just, you know, hey, they get a check every week, they can put up with whatever they're given?
How have I dealt with them? Well, first of all, I try to convince them that they need to think about a different approach, but many of them are recalcitrant. They're not going to do that. And so I do it the way most executives understand, dollars and cents. Three dedicated employees, three employees of genuine care for the company are worth five or six people who are just there. People who believe they're being treated fairly and think the company cares about them, do something that is sorely missed in corporate America, and that is they provide discretionary effort. And when I say discretionary effort, Bob, I mean that when the nickel stands on edge for a decision, and employees at even the lowest levels of an organization have to make decisions about productivity or about effort or about quality, when the nickel stands on edge about those decisions, dedicated employees push the nickel over on the side of the company. What would be best for the company? And when I say best for the company, not in taking advantage of shortcuts or anything, but what's best in the long run. Employees who are not engaged, who don't really care, they push the coin over on the side of themselves. Instead of staying till 5:15, they leave at 4:45. Instead of tightening that bolt one last time, you know, good enough is good enough, and so on and so on. Eventually, over long periods of time, those types of decisions discriminate companies with high levels of competitive advantage versus the run-of-the-mill companies.
What are some of the companies in the United States that treat their are known and respected for treating their employees in the manner that you describe?
Southwest Airlines is always had a reputation of being employee focused. And the interesting thing about Southwest Airlines, it is a highly unionized environment. Charles Schwab and Company. I mean, years ago, and this is just by point of example, but years ago, when their business was impacted by the dot-com implosion,
mm-hmm.
and it had, well, they asked for 10% reductions in salaries. But you know who took the 10% first? All the executives, leading by example. These are companies that care. Johnson & Johnson, I've already mentioned. They have a credo of how they will behave and how their employees and their managers will behave. They live up to it. Of course, my former company, I'm very proud to say, SAS Institute, the largest privately held software company in the world, has a reputation. They were named the number one best company to work for in America this year by Fortune magazine. There are many others, but I take that back. There are some others, not many, who really do have a reputation for fair, equitable, and adult treatment of their employees.
And that's really the issue, isn't it? It always amazes me. And I work with CEOs. I make my living writing books with CEOs, you know, who've accomplished something and want to tell their story. And it always amazes me that we run into these companies that do things so well, treat their employees well, and then there's just the next company could be next door. It doesn't do the same thing. They do not have the same respect. They do not value their employees anywhere near the same as the ones that are so successful at it.
I think some of that is cultural. Some companies are raised on a culture of either star power or rugged individualism or hardcore directive management, and the value, the philosophical valuing of people is lost in years of behaviors that, of course, are counterintuitive to me.
David, if you could get your hands on any corporation in the United States and fix its corporate culture with regard to employees, can you pick one or two that you know you think could stand to get this kind of help?
A corporation, yeah. How about General Motors?
Right, it's a good choice.
If I could, and I don't believe that it's even within the realm of possibility on the basis of demographics, my personal talent pool, and reality, I would love to take a shot at fixing General Motors. Because for years, the Big Three sat in the Detroit area and produced on the basis of the availability of a buying public. And when challenged to do something different, only one of the Big Three, and that's Ford Motor Company, chose to change the way they do business. And they did it by, a long time ago, coming to grips with their labor situation, trying to build a relationship with their unionized workforce, and coming out of that with the ability to produce a higher quality automobile with a sustainable marketability. And General Motors, by and large, over the years, has had an unbelievably contentious relationship with its employees from mid-management down. And I would love to take a shot at that. I don't think it's, I don't know that it's in the power or even the intellectual grasp that I have to do so, but it would be, to me, a wonderful challenge.
Do you think some companies just have to face up to it and sunset themselves because they've gotten too big, they've been around too long, they're incapable of change? They're the Titanic heading for that iceberg. They know the iceberg is there. They can't do anything to stop themselves.
I think that negative inertia, forward and right,
yep.
that negative momentum is something, it's just as you said, the Titanic, it's sort of like trying to turn the Queen Mary around in your bathtub. You know, it just is so difficult. And it's a lot easier to put Band-Aids on a situation and think you fixed it, because the next CEO or the next general manager or the next division head's going to have to deal with it, because you'll have your golden parachute and be gone.
Right.
And that gets just, you know, layer after layer of management, you know. And there is no magic elixir. There is no silver bullet. It's all about hard work, looking at the basics, and changing behavior. And the difficulty, Bob, for big companies is that the behaviors they have towards their people, towards their customers, the almost disdain they have is so calcified in the thoughts and in the feelings of the people, quote, they offend, that even a change in behavior would be looked on suspiciously and for years. So it might take a well-behaved company with regard to employee relations and customer relations, a well-behaved company 6 or 7 months to get back on track. It could take a large corporation with a history, it could take them 7 to 10 years. And the costs of doing that in market share and in, you know, and in productivity and so on and so forth could be, you know, devastating. I mean, it could almost be corporate suicide.
What's the new in your book? I mean, what can the reader learn here that he can't in Jim Collins' Good to Great or even Ken Blanchard's classic One Minute Manager?
You know, I wish with my heart and soul I could say to you, this is all, there's something new and exciting. It's not. Everything I write is common sense. And I had a friend introduce me to a person who told me that he had read the book. And he said, you know, it was really interesting, David. It was really interesting. But I don't know why anybody would buy it. It's all common sense. And I said, well, what was your, when you were still working, what was your role? He said, well, I was a CEO of it, and he named a company of a size of about $200 million a year. So not huge, but, you know, substantial business. And I said, and how many of these things did you apply? And he said, well, and I said, well, he said, well, I tried. I said, no, how many of these rules did you apply? And he had to admit, none of them. So here it is. You know what to do. It's common sense to do it. And you don't do it. So,
right.
You know, it's me beating the drum again is not adding anything new. I hope to bring together in a microcosm, you know, the realities with some examples of organizations that can do it and with some personal experience. But honestly, Bob, nothing new. Nothing new under the sun. Not under the sun.
Well, it's a unusually honest of you to say that. There you go.
but the,
I was thinking
the scary part is that Jim Collins, what he says, I mean, he packaged it differently, is really not a discovery learning experience for most people who are fairly well educated in business and have been around. And, you know, Ken Blanchard, delightful man and a great story, I mean, there's nothing new there. You know, the truth of the matter is most people read this stuff and say, oh, I knew that. And then there's a guy named Jeff Pfeffer, who's a professor at Stanford, who wrote a book that is one of my favorites. It's called The Knowing-Doing Gap. You know, yeah, we all know this. We just don't do it.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you about another guy, Chester Elton. Are you familiar with him?
I am not.
He and a partner have written a number of books with carrot in the title. Carrot and stick approach to employees.
Right, right.
They're very big on incentives and that kind of thing. And I suspect that their work would fit in well with yours. They're very focused on the value of incentives to employees and that kind of thing. But seem like a neat fit. I mean, I was going to say to you that some of the things you suggest, such as you provide ample and appropriate resources, they do seem rather obvious, and yet you know, I think any of us could point to a company that just doesn't do that.
And you wonder why. I mean, you know, saving a few bucks, you know, you have, I've said this for a number of years, Bob. You go out and you recruit somebody, and they're special. They have all this talent, and you bring them in the door, and you spend 3 days telling them the 17 ways they can get fired, all the rules that they better not violate, and how, what the pecking order is in the organization. It's like taking a guy to a gunfight and handing him a penknife. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. You completely stunt the creativity, the resourcefulness, and the money you've spent to bring in tremendous talent by not releasing it, by treating it as if it is special, the same way you treated it when you were trying to get it to come on board.
Mm.
Without, and I don't mean coddling. I mean respect, recognition, growth opportunities, encouragement, cheerleading, all within a set of guidelines rather than strict rules, guidelines, so that the person never has doubt if he or she is headed in the right direction. And if a person is good and talented and cares, that's all they need. That, you know, mm-hmm. you hand a 14-year-old child a football, they know where the goal line is, but you have to have a couple referees there making sure they do it the right way and stay in bounds, right?
Stay in bounds, exactly. Exactly. Well, folks, listen, you can find David Russo's new book, 17 Rules Successful Companies Use to Attract and Keep Top Talent, Why Engaged Employees Are Your Greatest Sustainable Advantage, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it online at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. David, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in on the book.
Thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure being with you today.
All right. Best to you. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with North America's top business leaders, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Isidore Sharp, founder of Four Seasons Hotels and Resorts, the business consultant Ken Blanchard mentioned earlier, Ed Droste, co-founder of Hooters Restaurants, or Dave Hagen, CEO of Boingo Wireless, and many more. And subscribe to Mr. Media, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. Sorry. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman or facebook.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give up a little piece of your day and listen to me cough. Thanks for listening, everybody.